Two-thirds of the world's Roman Catholics live in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. The Anglican Communion, which the American Episcopal Church is part of, is becoming more African-dominated. The Nigerian branch will soon be its largest representative. The spread of Christianity in the global South is moving Christianity in largely more conservative directions and is changing Christianity in ways that most North Americans and Europeans are unaware of. My guest, Philip Jenkins, is the author of the new book, The New Faces of Christianity, Believing the Bible in the Global South. It's a follow-up to his book, The Next Christendom, The Coming of Global Christianity. Jenkins is a distinguished professor of history and religious studies at Pennsylvania State University. He says that Christianity's growth in the Global South is connected to population growth, but he thinks it's also connected to the fact that many Africans and Asians relate to the Bible because it portrays a world they can recognize. What are some of the connections that you see between life the way it's described in the Bible and life the way it's lived now in Africa?
Some people have said that if you look at African Christianity, the greatest temptation and the greatest danger is that it is just so easy for people to identify with the Old Testament world. Even if people live in cities, they're familiar with communities around them which are nomadic, which practice polygamy, which still practice blood sacrifice, for example, which sacrifice animals as a normal part of everyday rituals. And when you know this world as something that is around you, it makes it much easier to understand the moral codes that are preached in the Old Testament. Many Christians I know believe thoroughly in the doctrine of atonement, which is a sacrificial doctrine. I'm sometimes tempted to ask my evangelical friends, when they talk about sacrifice and atonement, have they ever seen a sacrifice? Have they ever smelt a sacrifice? And for many Africans, the answer is yes. They don't need to be taught these basic ideas of atonement. They're all around them. The New Testament world also has its own kind of appeal. It's written above all for a world that is characterized by poverty, by hunger, by endemic sickness. And it's when you look at the Bible through African eyes, through many Asian eyes, that you realize these things, and in some cases you tend to see them for the first time. You realize just how much of the Bible is about food and hunger, just how much of the Bible is about perpetual sickness and the need for healing. And when people read a very familiar world, which is almost a documentary, if you like, and then they see the figure of Jesus, who is able to overcome the evils that they face in this world, that is a very powerful message.
Are there different stories within the Bible that are emphasized in countries in the Global South compared to the stories that are emphasized in the West?
There are whole genres, there are whole styles of literature, which I think alienate or leave cold people in the Global North that have an immense appeal in some Global South communities. For example, the most devoted American Bible reader tends to glaze over when he or she reads all the genealogies, so-and-so begat so-and-so. There are many tribal communities in Africa or Asia where this is part. This is among the most exciting part of the Bible, because how do you understand who somebody is unless you know where they come from? A genealogy like this shows God's intimate care for his people. Well, that's an extreme example. But some of the passages, some of the stories that carry enormous weight in the Global South, one of them is in the Epistle of James. The Epistle of James is not a particularly well-known or popular book in Global North Christianity. In the Global South, it's one of the most popular sources of sermon texts for one simple idea. The book is about the transience of life. It tells people that their life is a vapor, a mist. You don't know where you will be tomorrow. You can't say that you will be alive tomorrow. And you think about reading that in a community in Africa where the average age of death is 35. That's a powerful, literal comment. Interestingly, the appeal of James runs across denominations. I was recently reading a commentary on James by none other than the Dalai Lama, who thought that it preached excellent Buddhist truths as well as Christian truths. So I think by looking at the way people read the book in the Global South, we in the North can see whole parts of the Bible that maybe we've forgotten.
Well, you also talk about an emphasis on the supernatural and Christianity as it's practiced in much of the Global South.
Right. Not long ago, Jim Wallace made a very interesting point, which is he said, if you take references to the poor out of the Bible, you don't have much left. And he's absolutely right. But if you take references to angels, demons, exorcisms, and healings out of the Bible, once again, you're left with a pretty slim pamphlet. I think for many Bible readers in the Global North, stories of healings and exorcisms are almost an embarrassment. In Africa or Asia, these are seen as absolutely fundamental. They are a core part of the Christian message, just as they were in the first two or three centuries of Christianity. And you can look at this in different ways. I mean, you can, I suppose, see it as an example of, if you like, a superstitious mindset. But I would rather see it as an expression of power and of the democratization of power. Power is available to anyone, even if they don't possess the right spiritual credentials. If the people who can claim the power to exercise and heal are women and the young, then so be it. And very often they are. If you live in a world that is beset with fears of supernatural forces, and Christianity gives you a means of knowing that you are in control of those forces, they need no longer frighten you, that again is a very powerful cultural, intellectual message.
Are there ways in which the view of Jesus and the view of the devil are very different in churches in the Global South than in the Global North? I know we're making big generalizations here,
sure.
But I guess in some level you kind of have to if you're talking about such a large group of churches.
When you look at the visions of Jesus that we have in the Global North, it's only gradually that you realize how many of them are culturally conditioned, because Christianity grew up in a Greek world, a Roman world, a medieval European world. And that's exactly what Africans and Asians are doing today. They are placing Jesus in contexts that make sense in those particular cultures. A couple of examples, for instance, in Africa, one of the very powerful ideas is Jesus as the great ancestor. In a society in which ancestors are all, in which what ancestors do still affects you, the idea that Jesus is the most powerful ancestor of all, and can, you know, scatter any curses or inheritances like that that have been left, is, again, powerful. And a word I'm going to use again and again, it's liberating. The other key one is Jesus as healer. Global South Christianity succeeds because, above all, it is a healing religion. It is a religion that people seek healing, not just in the sense of healing of the body. You know, I very much doubt if many people can produce film of faith healers healing broken legs, but healing of the problems of the spirit, the soul. South American Pentecostal churches, for example, healing very often means healing from substance abuse in the context of the church and the community. If you want to think of that as therapy rather than healing, fine. These are different words for the same thing.
Are most of the Christians in the Global South evangelical Christians?
A lot of northern world labels don't make very good sense in the Global South. I've certainly had the experience of asking a Nigerian Anglican, where you get very frustrated trying to pin them down and say, look, are you evangelical or Catholic or charismatic? And they will smile and say, yes. At terms like evangelical, don't work very well. In northern world terms, in terms of, if you like, a literal interpretation of the Bible, yes, they're evangelical, but that label also extends to, for instance, many Catholics. You find charismatic ideas across the board. So the denominational labels we have in the North don't work quite so well.
Given the increase in the size of the Catholic population in the Global South, do you see a time perhaps sometime in the near future, when the Pope would come from a country in the global south? And if so, how do you think that might change the church?
If you look at the numbers within the Catholic Church, it is overwhelmingly likely not just that the next pope will be from the global south, but that most popes for the foreseeable future will be from the global south. Just to put this in perspective, already today, two-thirds of Roman Catholics are from Africa, Asia, Latin America, and that does not count people from those continents living in the global north. It does not count, for example, Mexican Americans. By the time you get to 2050, something like 80% of the world's Catholics will be global south. John Paul II appointed a great many cardinals from, especially from Latin America and Africa, but even so, after all his efforts, those cardinals are still very underrepresented. I think it is more than likely that, I suppose, the future of the church's leadership will be a Latin American and African leadership. Increasingly, as the church becomes a southern church, so the issues that matter in the south come to be the central issues. I think in the short to middle term, a church could be more conservative on sexual issues, issues of sexual preference. But also, I think it could be more progressive on social, economic issues, issues of poverty, world debt, and so on. So I think it could be a mixed message. I say again and again, it's so important not to apply a simple northern world liberal-conservative divide. Somebody can be very conservative on some issues, very liberal on others.
From the travels that you've made through the global south, can you tell us one of the most interesting visits you've had to a church that kind of represents how different some services are there compared to what you might see in the United States where you live?
I'm going to duck around that question a little bit, and I'm going to tell you what is one of my favorite stories, which is not mine, but is a story from a friend, which is one of the best indications I know, which is I was once talking to an Adventist pastor who was an American who was describing visiting a church in South Africa where you had this vast congregation crammed into this tiny hall. And as he walked in, people were very surprised to see a white face in this room, in an area where white people were not normally very visible. And gradually people talked to him and found out that he was a pastor, and this was an ordained pastor, and this was a wonderful thing. And the word went up to the platform where the clergyman conducting the service said, "Oh, my friends, I have wonderful news for you. Pastor Smith has come to us all the way from the United States to visit us, and I'm going to ask him to conduct tonight's exorcism." And I sometimes tell that story when I'm speaking to church or seminary audiences, and you can see people turn pale as they imagine how they'd cope with the situation.
What did Pastor Smith do?
Based on his knowledge of films about exorcism, he apparently did very creditably.
So I guess that's an example of how exorcism is widely practiced in the global south?
Of course. But it's not just widely practiced, but it's standard, which is a church which does not carry out exorcisms really has to come up with a good reason for it. And, you know, this is a situation you get with Catholic churches, for example. Catholic churches have to produce all these manuals and guides for how priests are to cope when somebody comes to them complaining that they're possessed. What do they do? How do they cope with pleas for healing, for exorcism? And what they have to do is draw on the church's resources without making what they regard as too great concessions to superstition. But as I sometimes say, if you are not prepared to deal with issues of healing and exorcism, and you're considering a career in religion in Africa, then consider a different career.
Well, Philip Jenkins, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Philip Jenkins is the author of the new book, The New Faces of Christianity. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a track from the original cast recording of Guys and Dolls, featuring Isabel Bigley, who played the missionary Sister Sarah. Bigley died Saturday at the age of 80.
Ask me how do I feel. Ask me now that we're cozy and clean.